Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. Bob Carr makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's been a friend of the Institute for a long time, and he's spoken here on quite a few occasions. But tonight, on the occasion of the publication of Bob Carr, Run for Your Life. Now, our speaker is very well known, but I will introduce him briefly. Professor the Honourable Bob Carr was the longest continuously serving Premier in the history of New South Wales. He entered state politics in 1983 as the member for Labor Party member for Maroubra, and he retired in 2005. And then he entered the Federal Senate in 2012 and served as Australia's Foreign Minister for 18 months during the period of the Gillard and then the Rudd government. Since leaving politics, Bob Carr has had a distinguished career as an author and academic, and he's the director of the Australia-China Relations Institute at the University of Technology, Sydney. And tonight, talking on the topic of his book, Run for Your Life, a personal memoir. Mr. Carr, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Jared, thank you, and it's a great honour to be here at the Sydney Institute, which is unique and a great sorting house for ideas, especially on politics. I was elected leader of my party on April Fool's Day, 1988, which was not auspicious. It meant, however, that one of my first official duties was the dawn service a few weeks later. And my first dawn service as party leader, I was very nervous arriving there in George Street to go up through the crowds in Martin Place. I was so shy, I remember going through the arcade of the post office rather than walking up in front of the crowds. When the crowds, the leader of the opposition had no function but to be there, which is often the case, which is really a statement of what a leader of the opposition is, a footnote on events. And as the crowds dispersed, there was Graham Freudenberg, fondly regarded by many of us. He was then speechwriter on Bob Hawke's staff. His father had been an Anzac. He recruited me and we went. There was nothing else to do before 6 in the morning. He took me up to Hawke's office, just over there, Jared, looking down on your former premises. There was nothing to eat in the office, not even a biscuit. But there was, standing alone in a liquor cabinet, a bottle of sherry. Graham uncorked it, and before 6 in the morning I was sipping tentatively on a sherry, sweet or dry, I forget, looking out the window. And Freudenberg said to me, looking down on those terraces, he said, "You know," he said, "it's worth being in politics just to be able to sign off on the saving of those buildings," because I'd done that as Minister for Planning and Environment before we'd been tipped into opposition. And in a sense, my book is about what you can do in politics. And if there's someone in the Young Liberals or the Greens or my own party who reads this book and thinks, "I'm going to go into public life, I'm going to go into politics, I'm going to go through all that Carr went through to get there, to claw my way in and to get to test my judgment, making decisions," I'll be very satisfied. And that's one reason, a large reason, why I opted to do it and to do it in a way that I think is different and entertaining. And through this, there's the flavour of Whitlam, but there's the flavour too of Neville Rann. And I have a chapter here which for some of you will be very evocative, I think, because you grew up being enthralled to his personality, realist, brutally realist as it was, cynical as it was, self-educated, optimistic, dismal at times, Well, there's one story that stands out, and I quote it here. He'd been in what Terry Sheehan got caught out describing as the sin bin, when he had to step down and face a royal commission. But then he returned triumphantly and vindicated, and he did a media conference, and as a journalist from the Bulletin, but someone hoping to get into politics soon myself, I couldn't be dissuaded from turning up and listening to him. So Neville's back. He's happy to be back, but unhappy with what he's been through. The issue in the media while he's been away has been GASP branch stacking in inner city ALP branches. So he gets asked a question about it. What's he going to say about this, I think? And he says in response to a question about stacking in inner city ALP branches, bang, came his retort, go and look at the Liberal Party. They've got more dummies there than a David Jones front window. And I thought the media were astonished by this. It had nothing to do with the issue. But there was absolutely no follow-up that was conceivable to this. It was in every way a brilliant response. It was just so good. Like when he was asked about Anita Cobby tragedy and the case for reinstating capital punishment. Remember, this was back in the 80s or late 70s. And he was faced with this. There's a lot of the electorate that would have been comfortable with a return of capital punishment, and how do you face a crime that cruel, that hideous, without contemplating it? And Neville said capital punishment would be too good for them, and demonstrated to me it was possible to be on both sides of an argument. Quite honourably, to be on both sides of the argument, namely, capital punishment would be suitable in this case, you are right, but at the same time, we're not going to do it. And that was a reassurance to everyone who's repelled by the notion. But I remember with all his qualities, there was this understanding of the elector who had to be attended to. Once, when I thought we were doing well as an opposition, we'd brought down a few ministers, there was a reasonable number of corruption scandals simmering along, had a few campaigns going, the polls weren't altogether desperate. I thought he might pat me on the head and tell me we're doing reasonably. He said, all this bringing down corrupt ministers is good as far as it goes. I remember him saying that, as far as it goes. That is, it sustains a day in the media. But he said, but you've got to think of the bloke who makes $400 a week. His wife's got a lump in her breast. His fibro house at Liverpool is missing a panel. He's a drink going home. She's locked his dinner back in the oven. He doesn't care what's happening in the upper house, what scandal's happening. He's concerned about his job, her health. And coming from a bloke who lived in Wallara, that wasn't a bad reminder of the basics flowing through our political system. I once overheard him telling a newly elected Nick Greiner at a state function, I think it was the visiting King and Queen of Spain. So I was there at the top table. He was chatting to the new premier. He said to him, and again, this was his brutal realism. He said, your ministers are irrelevant. They just want to be driven around town in their cars. The fact is, everything you need, you've got to do yourself. And I conclude in this little memoir, in an egalitarian party, he was a Bonapartist. He was a Bonapartist. He knew it all resolved in the leader and the leader's office. And in a sense, this is a way of understanding the pattern of New South Wales politics in the post-war period, post-1941, periods of domination by strong leaders, McKell, Carl, Askin, and Greiner there, because of his focus on policy achievement, and intervening periods of mostly short premierships. The doctor's strike or the Breeze affair and the two-man crewing of trains are forgotten, issues that were the headlines during his premiership. What's left is a better quality of life. And as we look at it now, a decade flavoured by his big personality. I was recruited to the Labor Party. I joined the Labor Party because I was instinctively a kind of social democrat. My father was a train driver, and he'd talk Labor mythology in our house. A lot of talk about Chifley. So this is This is in the early 60s. I'm a 13 or 14 year old listening to my dad, and Chifley figures very big. Not interestingly, I say to John Edwards, the Curtin biographer, not interestingly, Curtin. Chifley dominated the imagination of my father, my uncle, and a lot of the Labour Party rhetoric, something that was to shift over time. But drawing on the Chifley mythology or the Chifley legend, my father was able to invoke a Labour past that somehow captured me with the romantic notion of being a career politician on the Labour side of politics. And at 15, I was signed up. That's the only thing I wanted to do. I was someone who'd rather have that, be an elected official, than be editor of the Times or governor of the chairman of the Federal Reserve or anything else I could possibly imagine. At university, I was never recruited by the left. Marxism didn't appeal to me. I remember getting angry one day in the library as I read accounts of the Soviet repression of workers' uprisings in Berlin 53 and Hungary 1955, not aware that in the year I was reading this, there was about to be another brutal suppression of workers and patriots in what was to happen in Prague later that year. I remember turning up at a Young Labour meeting and saying to Percy Allen, now a good friend, then a frightening figure on the left. I'd been recruited by Keating and Brereton to the right. I'm saying, was chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee. I'm saying, the Foreign Affairs Committee of Young Labour. I said, we've just carried a very strongly worded motion condemning the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. And he said, well, that's all very good, Bob. I've just come back from a demonstration outside the Soviet embassy in Wallara. I thought he'd one-up me with that one. A bit of old-fashioned direct action from the left had done me in. But I was always on that side of the politics, and a major driver in me being a recruit to the right was my admiration for Gough Whitlam. My lack of interest in Marxism was there. My sympathy for the United States, which I read about in Time magazine. I was no highbrow. My serious disdain for the Soviets, but above all, my admiration for Gough Whitlam. And I write in the book about the day he came to my red brick campus, the University of New South Wales. I was so excited by his arrival, I hadn't been able to sleep the night before. And then when he arrived, I saw the brilliant-eyed hair, the great pink fleshy features with the Roman nose, the towering figure and the pigeon chest encased in a tailored light grey suit that was narrow in accordance with the fashion dictates of the mid-60s. Here he was speaking in that somewhat breathy, stagey accent with the verbal precision he was famous for and giving us his stump speech. I say, there was not a word in it I missed. Not an argument I didn't file in the cabinet of my prefrontal cortex ready to deploy when required. A new recruit to the circle of our Lord's discipleship sitting on a bluff above the waters of the Jordan could not have been more attentive to the words of his prophet. The great man made the case for Labour. Oh, how I had longed for someone to do that. Labour's leaders were the mothballed pedestrian figures from that ancient 1941 to 1965 state government, so recently voted out of office. They were Arthur Augustus Caldwell, who would never compete with Robert Menzies, and Caldwell's colleagues such as Fred Daly. I wanted Whitlam as the party leader. I wanted to see a reforming Labour government led by a serious figure, eloquent and erudite. And Whitlam didn't disappoint me with his speech in the campus that lunchtime. And I remember him using favourite Whitlamisms like, in all comparable countries. And I just love that style. He was dismissive of state governments. He mentioned that the agent general of one of them, I think it was Western Australia or Victoria, had taken it upon himself to write a letter to the Times defending South Africa's apartheid. So Whitlam spoke about him with contempt. So I was a Whitlam supporter. I was instinctively drawn to the New South Wales right because it supported Whitlam, whereas the left in the party wanted to expel Whitlam and came very close to doing it, which from my point of view would have doomed Labour as a serious party of government and reform. I was fully admiring of the Social Democratic Parties of Europe. And when Helena and I made our first pilgrimage to Europe, I used it as an opportunity to collect arguments to use against the left in the New South Wales Labour Party and Young Labour and the other forums. I think I was out of Young Labour then. And I learnt that, and I thought these were killer arguments, even the unemployed in West Germany and Scandinavia have higher per capita living standards, even the unemployed, than the workers in the Eastern Bloc. Social Democrats, I concluded after my profound study of the Herald Tribune and a few conversations with the Deutsche Gewerkschaftsbund, the German unions, Social Democrats must stand as opposed to the Marxist-Leninists as to the conservative right. And I'd reach this view that while the British Labour Party wearily devotes its conferences to debating further nationalisation of its stagnant industries, the Swedish Party is committing itself to real democratisation of ownership in a growth economy. My hero was Helmut Schmidt, the Chancellor, Social Democratic Chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany. As opposition leader in New South Wales, I got most things wrong. I stumbled along. My image was appalling. I quote what Graham Richardson told John Della Bosca, party secretary, and my staff in a Chinese restaurant. I got a full account from Chris Neal, my staffer, and I got her to recreate it for me here over the rattle of the chopsticks. There was a thoroughgoing condemnation of how Carr was handling his role as opposition leader. He'd once been heard to quote Shakespeare. There's too much focus on the environment. He's been known to give a speech on Abraham Lincoln. We've got to get him to the football. This became totemic. Sometimes with a glass of beer in his hand. Even McCarthy got recruited for this. He told one of McCrory's colleagues, I'm going to get Bob to the cricket and I'm going to make him smear sunscreen on his nose and sit there under a Terry Towling hat. I say in the book that having the KGB imprison me in a cockroach-infested cupboard for a day would have been a lesser form of torture than what my mate John McCarthy was prescribing. But I got a few things right in opposition. I think opposition is an opportunity to make some strategic decisions. And I made a few, and I'll just share them with you, because they actually got to shape a fair bit of the policy agenda in New South Wales politics. I said as opposition leader in 1988 at my first faltering, barely articulate, very nervous media conference that we would stick with the forest conservation agenda I'd been part of as Neville Rand's Minister for Planning and Environment. We'd stick with that. We'd veer to the green agenda. But I also made it clear, facing Greiner's budgetary reforms, that we would commit to fiscal restraint, balanced budgets, debt reduction, public sector reform, including corporatisations. And I said that when our AAA rating was in doubt in 1992. And that was vital because it meant when other state Labor governments started crashing down, Victoria and South Australia, collapse of state banks and all the rest, people were at least to say, well, hang on, Carr's been saying he's a fiscal conservative. And that got us through. If I'd taken the opposite course and said more debt is good for us, don't focus on debt, we would have been very vulnerable. Importantly as well, I supported the Greiner government's establishment of the ICAC in 1988 in the face of some opposition within Labor Party ranks. That was a very important statement of where we would stand. A different leader might have taken a different approach. I also said that we would adopt explicit law enforcement policies that tilted more to the victims of crime and less to the civil liberties of those committing crimes. We anticipated instinctively what Tony Blair said and meant by tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. Because I thought our working class base, people who lived in public housing, were entitled to have a government that said, no, we're protecting you, not focusing on the rights and mobilising apologies for those who are making your life hell. And finally, I supported a schools agenda that committed to skill testing, reporting to parents, rigorous curricula, and external exams with a focus on literacy. That continued to be thematic. I had a few critics in my party who said, you're traumatising our kids with additional tests. I said, I think that's what parents want. They want to know if a teacher is letting their kids down. At the present time, we haven't got tests in year five or at the start of year seven to give them that assurance. We're just wheeling out a bureaucrat from the local office to tell them that, yes, at Malabar Primary School, all is good. A test result would be objective and therapeutically deployable feedback. Opposition can be a useful time. Few people will report it, but you can lay down a position. And that can be a big investment in your agenda in government, although it may not be noticed at the time. One of our biggest commitments in opposition I took in an almost cavalier fashion. John Hatton came to me on two occasions to seek a Royal Commission into the New South Wales Police. He did not have evidence of systemic corruption. When he came to see me the second time, I thought, damn it. I've got less than a year to go before the next state election. The police have disappointed me on a few fronts. Less than systemic corruption, but then clearly not performing well in New South Wales. I said to myself, I may be out of a job in 8 months' time. Damn it, I'll swing our party behind Hatton's motion. Switched to the debate in the Parliament in May 1994, Hatton's moving his motion, and he's talking with resort to very dated, yellowing clippings from the National Times about things that were 15 years old. There was no fresh material. I went up to his speechwriter, who's bringing his pages down a few at a time, and said, Arthur, can you get to some contemporary stuff? I've swung the Labor Party behind the motion. My speech is ready, but your boss ain't making a case for systemic corruption. Well, late that night, we carried the motion. The media overlooked the weakness in the case. As Premier, having won the election in the next year, I sat in my office a few weeks into the job and got a report from the Royal Commissioner, who told me, Police Royal Commission, I've marked it in blue. 7 weeks after I became Premier, Justice James Wood is there. And I said to him nervously, I remember the nervousness with which I put it, because I thought I would be acutely embarrassed if he was going to be saying to me, we've had a good look round and there's a few incidents, there's a bit of opportunistic stuff, but I've got to tell you, Premier, the motion you backed 6 months ago. Anyway, I said something like, Your Honour, and I put it this way, are you finding anything? Justice Wood assured me his investigation had obtained substantial material. I was very relieved, and on the 5th of June 1995, someone called Chuck Fowler became a name to conjure with, and I was relieved. One of the most important things we did as a government was to take those recommendations of the Police Royal Commission, and they were big, bold recommendations. No previous Premier would have contemplated them. We needed the shock of a Royal Commission to be able, for example, to institute integrity testing. No one had done that. And it was pretty bold to plant a plastic bag of white paper in a wreck at an abandoned car and videotape the response of the local police when they were called to it, testing their integrity. Drug and alcohol testing for on-the-job police. Above all, something that caused a challenge for my caucus, giving the police commissioner the power to sack anyone in whom he or she had lost confidence. Unfair dismissal? Forget it. But I had a police commissioner telling me, we cannot clean out this police force unless you give me that power. It had to go to caucus twice. As for the media, the chapter in my book dealing with media relations is called The Sausage Roll Affair. I'm turning up at a media conference in my last election, 2003. We're announcing the rezoning of a major block of land at Greystanes for industrial purposes. It means on the edge of the M7 West Link, a road we were building as a private-public partnership, the longest toll road in Australia, the longest urban road in Australia, a major piece of infrastructure without this city, without which this city wouldn't work. We would have a great quantity of land for any investors, warehousing, manufacturing on the edge of this north-south road link in Western Sydney. I thought it was pretty important, and I wanted it to be our announcement of the day during the 2003 election campaign. As I'm strolling to the lectern, I noticed two young journalists from the Telegraph eating sausage rolls with full-strength Coke. So I made what I hope was a friendly, I trust not a smart-ass comment to them. I said, not the healthiest breakfast. Not the healthiest breakfast. And then went on to make the announcement. The next morning, my hand went up to turn on the radio as I lay in bed, and an announcement came that made me feel for a couple of seconds as if the earth had tilted, as if I'd been thrown into an alternative universe. It said, the state's pastry cooks are up in arms today at the assault by the Premier of New South Wales. I thought, assault, pastry cooks, attack on the sausage roll. And then it fell into place. It was a front page story in the Telegraph. There was, of course, no coverage of the major zoning decision that was related to jobs, Western Sydney, the connection between jobs. I wasn't quoted saying the customary journey from home to work in Western Sydney is soon going to be from east to west. None of that. Now, I was happy to go along. I'm not griping about the media. I conclude in this chapter that if you've been leader of your party for 17 years, you know, by today's standards, 10 and a half of them in government as premier, you are not entitled to complain about the media. You're just not entitled to. Either they're less effective than you imagined, or there are other alternatives, but you just can't complain about them. But I did find it a bit rich when later on some people in the media said that Carr, he manipulated us, were manipulated. Look at how he got sausage rolls onto the front page in that last election campaign. That I thought was unfair. That I thought warrants criticism. In the spirit, I'm concluding with this, Jared. I found a few times in the book that I was invoking Gough Whitlam. I didn't expect it. I didn't plan it. But when I spoke about us as a state government shifting hospital resources in a big, concentrated way to Sydney's west and making a difference to the lives of people who lived, a woman who lived in Green Valley and might be seeking treatment for breast cancer, I suppose the family that Neville ran was telling me I had to tend to. And she was able, as a result of our investment, to get that treatment at Liverpool Hospital or Bankstown Hospital and not have to come to Prince Henry Hospital by bus and by rail. I was thinking about Whitlam and Whitlam's great focus on geographic equity in services. When I spoke about what we did for lifetime care for people injured in motor accidents, I thought that was a little bit of Whitlam's great vision of national compensation. I spoke about Whitlam on the campus, inspiring me and people like me with his vision of Australia and Australian politics. A few other occasions too, I found myself in China policy, invoking Gough and Gough's vision. Even though at the start of the book, when I'm talking about myself in the 70s, it was Rann, not Gough. Gough too adversarial, anti-business, too challenging for middle ground Australia. But I came to a fond view of Whitlam, and in the penultimate chapter, I talk about Whitlam 4 days into his job as Prime Minister when he's meeting the heads of the Department of Foreign Affairs. And the issue is expeditiously recognising China, and I think it's Renouf in Paris who's carrying those negotiations through. But there's one other thing. How we should vote on the annual motion on apartheid that's presented in the General Assembly. And Gough's going to switch our vote because up till now, Australia has been voting against motions that condemn apartheid. Voting them down. Gough's going to change, but remember what he said when he was on campus about the shame of having agent generals representing Australia in London, representing the states in London, write letters to the Times defending apartheid. Now, that was in the 60s, appalling. So Whitlam's changing. And the heads of the department, Australia's senior diplomats, suggest Australia moving from voting no on these motions that condemn apartheid to abstaining would be the appropriate course. To go from voting no to voting yes would be precipitate. And Whitlam says, we're voting for the motions that condemn apartheid. And here's my little tribute to Gough. I say in this short chapter, it's only a page and a half, I say another Labour Prime Minister might have accepted the advice of the diplomats, but not Gough. I say, I wonder if Whitlam, as he reverses Australia's voting, allows himself a few seconds to reflect that all his years in public life might have been a preparation for this moment. Giving that instruction to Australian diplomats, does he feel that all the nights spent in suburban halls and country motels, or the days cadging TV exposure, or speaking to an ALP club on a red brick campus, that this is all vindicated at this moment, that his very career in politics is corroborated at this moment? Switching Australia's vote and sending a message to the world about his nation's new character, does he allow himself to think at this time at his desk, I am my job, and public life in Parliament is entirely worth the effort, and no other job I, Gough, might have had? The High Court, UN diplomacy, professor of classics at Cambridge University, could possibly rival this. Does he think, too, that his party, barnacled and bruised like the toughest old sperm whale, a survivor of the Pacific whaling grounds, is, with all its scars and imperfections, the essential medium for delivering change? At that moment, I think Gough thinks all of the above. And like his speechwriter, Graham Freudenberg, on that Anzac morning, looking in the semi-darkness down on your former premises, Gerard, I think, wouldn't you be in politics? Wouldn't you be in politics to be able to sign off on something that makes a difference you think important? That's the spirit of my book. Thank you very much.
Many thanks, Bob Carr. Now, as I said earlier, we have copies of Bob Carr's Run for Your Life. I think any profits from the book will go to child victims of the Syrian civil war. And we've got some copies for sale at the end. Just to clarify the point that Mr. Carr made, this is our old premises at 41 Phillip Street, which were the terraces, say, when Bob was the Environment Minister in the RAN government, right? So there are five terraces on Phillip Street which are currently being done up, which is why we've moved here. And so we come to questions and discussion. I think if you can just come back up. Can I just... I'm going to disappear on this side, if you can come back to this side. And just start off with your comments on Gough Whitlam. I mean, you make the point that there was a serious move to get rid of Whitlam and... to put in Jim Cairns, and as I recall, I think accurately, it sort of came out of Melbourne, and the man running the campaign for Jim Cairns to toss out Gough Whitlam was none other than Philip Adams, as I recall. He was the campaign manager for... well, Gough told me that, so it must be right. But tell us, you've spoken a bit about the personal Neville Rand. Tell us a bit about the Whitlam personal man, because as I recall, you told me in Whitlam's final years that the kind of affable Gough that we saw then was not the sort of guy who was running the Labour Party in opposition or Prime Minister. You presented to me in a private conversation someone who could be very aggressive to his colleagues, condescending, difficult. What was that side of him? Because we always saw the learned side, the witty side, but you obviously saw another side.
Yeah, it was a big one for slamming doors. And on one occasion, young Paul Keating told me this, in his first months in the federal parliament, Keating would absorb all this, and he was like a, to us in Young Labour, he was like a someone returning from a extraterrestrial space with stories of wonders he'd seen. And Keating said, "He said, oh yes, they're around there, yeah, putting in a new glass pane in Whitlam's door." He said he'd slammed it with such force. And I remember Rand was near traumatised once. He'd been summoned with other Labour leaders over to the Prime Minister's residence, and they're all there to see Gough as Prime Minister. Neville's still leader of the opposition at this time, so let's say it's 1974 or 75. Whitlam came out of his office and he saw all the state Labor leaders there queuing to see him. And he used one of his favourite nouns. He said, "Well, what do you pissants want?" So he was impatient and gloriously rude. And he said things that were shockingly, used language that was shockingly politically incorrect. You couldn't get by saying them within microphone reach these days. But it was, he became that fond old man in retirement. And someone who was easy to love for his stories. I'd love to have him with us now and get him to... He'd talk, for example, with precision about Canberra culture of the 1950s. He'd say, "Oh, in those days," he said, "they wouldn't allow Catholics to be head of more than two federal government departments. So there'd be a Catholic, and you'd probably correct this, there'd be one Catholic in cabinet, and there'd be one who'd be head of the Department of Customs. You'd have a Catholic head of the federal police for one term, and they have to find an on." He stored that away. It'd be a marvellous, and he knew ecclesiastical history. According once talking about an Archbishop of Taiwan. I don't know where this came from, but if it's possible, if it weren't for his Enlightenment rationalism, and I think he said to me when he came in to brief me on what I should do as opposition, he said, "Ignore the churches." He said, "Ignore the churches. They've got no impact." But I've never encountered anyone with a deeper interest in ecclesiastical matters and ecclesiastical history. So just a wonderful, rich personality. And if we levitate ourselves above the woeful performance of his government in some respects, you are looking at someone who must attract the adjective visionary.
Thank you. There's a question over here. Just stay here. Yeah, there's a question there.
Mr. Carr, you've mentioned that a man with your political success can't blame the press, so that takes away one possible answer to this question. You mentioned that the leader of the opposition has nothing to do but turn up, is essentially invisible. I've often wondered why it is that that's true of the leader of the state opposition, but the leader of the federal opposition is highly visible, and that's always been the case. Why is it that the state leader of the opposition can never get the running in the press, whereas the leader of the federal opposition always can?
Well, he did get a running in the press when I was opposition leader at a state level, but it's just that it was always open to criticism. And I quoted some of that criticism. I think it's very amusing. And it's there in the book, in a chapter entitled "In the Chinese Restaurant." I think the challenge they got today is the fragmented nature of the media. In my day, you could fight your way on to a 7-second grab on free-to-air TV news. And you had the sense that if I'd gone on the 7:45 ABC News, the 7:45 ABC radio news, that the opinion elite of the state was listening to me. Who can say that today? It's a fragmented media, which shouldn't doom a politician. It creates wonderful opportunities. But I would not give advice to Luke Foley on handling media today.
Okay, so there's a question. Yeah. Well, there's a question there. If you just get the microphone there. Okay. And then we'll come here. Okay.
Hello.
Push it up a bit further.
Okay, let's go. Okay. Well, just speak up, Jim.
Shout.
Mr. Carr, the comments about Gough, I remember one remark he made to me at the state funeral at St. Mary's Cathedral.
He said, "You know, you Catholics do it so well," he said, "it'd be a good enough reason for me to convert." My question is just this. You referred, and we know you came up in the ALP Wright School with Richo and Paul and Jono Johnson, and we all miss Jono. He was a wonderful man, did a lot of things for the state and the nation as a whole. But you made some comments about the left wing, and I might just mention those, that one of the credos of the left is more debt is good for us. And you also made a comment that none of us would challenge, and that was that a left victory would have consigned Whitlam and Labor to oblivion. How would you apply those comments to the current leader of the federal opposition these days? Because he doesn't seem to follow either of those axioms.
Oh, and I think that's unfair to Bill Shorten. In any case, politics has shifted. Politics has shifted. In my time, I followed Neville Rand's dictum that Labor governments had to neutralise what Neville called the big end of town. My view was that I would go into an election as opposition leader without the boardrooms having any gripe against me. And during my time as Premier, business would be saying, behind closed doors, Carr's the best Liberal Premier we ever had. That was my goal. I had no fight with business, as opposed to individual businesses like James Hardie that had done the wrong thing. Our job was not simply to hand out things to trade unions, and I've got two chapters dealing with the complexity of industrial relations for a Labor government, but politics has changed. There is an anti-business sentiment now that wasn't around then, and there is a scepticism about the fiscal austerity agenda that wasn't around then. I think 2008, the crisis of 2008, has got a lot to explain. The Bernie Sanders agenda, Jeremy Corbyn as leader of the British Labour Party, the only leftist leader they've had apart from Michael Foote, Neil Kinnock ending up from the centre. I mean, that's a big shift in what had been one of the world's great social democratic parties. I think federal Labor under Shorten's leadership is achieving the right balance of accommodating this new anti-business mood, but at the same time, with the budgetary parameters they've adopted, not leaving themselves open to criticism for fiscal irresponsibility.
There's a question here. We're broadly having questions on the topic of the talk, okay?
Yes, as a great admirer also of Gough Whitlam, you and he shared something in common, and I just wanted your thoughts about why was Gough Whitlam so enamoured with Mark Labor?
I'm not sure my relationship with Latham could ever have been described in those terms. I think you're...
As a staff member.
I was a staff member. Yeah, he was on my staff, but he was pretty restless, so you could... be something more than a staff member. I think it was sad for Gough, who'd clearly invested a lot of hopes in Mark Latham, saw him as being responsive to Gough's own agenda for regional equity, that is, lifting the level of resources available for disadvantaged areas in Sydney's Greater West. I think very sad for Gough to see Mark Latham turn his back on the party that has sustained him. I'm surprised that anyone can do that. I think institutional loyalties do count. And Joseph Conrad had one of his characters say, "Be loyal to the nightmare of your choice." And I chose at 15 to be part of this political creation, this Australian version of social democracy, and I think it makes more sense, despite all its obvious flaws, to stay in that outfit and work for what we know is not possible. Perfection. This side of the grave, Jim. Perfection this side of the grave.
I remember you saying when Mark Latham was elected Labor leader, you were asked for a comment, you said, "That'll be an interesting 12 months." And he lasted 11, I think.
I think the adjective I used was diverting. I think that this will be Mark Latham as Labor leader. That'll be a diverting 12 months. Jared's got a very good political memory. He and I are the only people who can recall that in 1965, the Federal Parliamentary Labor Party actually carried a motion endorsing the Vietnam War.
Anne.
think Bob Ellis was someone who used to hang around your office a bit and write the occasional this and that. And considering Bob's sort of outpourings of whatever, venom, craziness, whatever, how was it that you and Bob got together? Bob Ellis, I mean.
Yeah, well, I think we shared a love of history. He loved words. How good is that movie, Bob? Have you seen that movie? And you'd say it solemnly. You'd say it could be the greatest movie ever made, and be a movie that wouldn't live in your memory for more than a week and a half. But he did love words, and he took the theatre as seriously as it deserves to be taken. The recent revelation about him, and we've got to assume that it's true, that these things wouldn't have been said if they weren't true, means that those of us who are very fond of him and deeply saddened at his passing have got to live with the challenge of another memory, very different from the memory we want to dwell on, of Bob Ellis. As someone who loved words, he was capable of producing a brilliant speech, not one that I might have read into the record without reading it, as I might a speech by Freudenberg welcoming an American president or the Majesty the Queen. Bob's always needed more careful attention. But a speech he gave me in tribute to the Bali dead. I made a few changes, but they were very beautiful words, and as someone who had a contingent of constituents who lost their lives in Bali, I know the words did match the demands of our attention and our sorrow. And that's the Bob Ellis I prefer to remember.
Judy Stevens, Mr. Carr. I worked with you and your party, Lifetime Care and Support, with David Bowen, MAA. Thank you very much for the good work you did, and it's made a difference to motor vehicle accident people in the legislation. We pushed through it.
Thank you.
You might just briefly describe what that was. That was a change to motor accident.
Yeah. The essence of it is that we took a big step with tort law reform. My side of politics had been very indebted to plaintiff lawyers, not prepared to take them on workers' comp or in other areas. The system was being crammed with legalisms that were increasing costs and reducing payouts to victims. When we reformed motor vehicle accident insurance to bring down the cost of green slips, we found we had an opportunity. We found we had an opportunity to institute a little surcharge that would fund whole-of-life care for people catastrophically injured in motor accidents. They'd have whole-of-life care if they'd been catastrophically injured in motor accidents. So it was a no-fault scheme too, so it was a significant reform. But off the back of the bigger reform, which was tackling tort law.
Trevor.
Well, given Neville Rann's great legacy and his great period in government, one of his last monuments is the Powerhouse Museum, which is now in the process of being destroyed by the present government. And most of the Labor Party are absolutely silent on this issue. What can we do about it?
My advice to them is to speak up in favour of the Powerhouse Museum in its current location, and to achieve regional equity, deliver a community bus service that meets the needs of school students and other community members to reach that outstanding concentration of technological and design marvels. I think no good case, no good plan has been made for shifting it to Parramatta. And that's an alternative that enables people to reach it.
Trevor,
Thank you, Mr. Carr. What do you think of the current relationship between China and Australia? Is there a need for improvement?
Yeah, I deal with that, Leonard, in my book. There's a chapter which I entitled China Panic. And I addressed it in an article 2 weeks ago on the opinion pages of the Financial Review. I'm not advocating anything more than a return to the pragmatism of the China policy we had in the last year of the Abbott government. There's been a tilt since then. But Abbott was pragmatic enough to sign Australia up to the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, being sponsored at the time by China, and once in the bank, to negotiate changes in governance that met Western demands. Australia took a lead on that. Under Abbott, we said no from time to time to the Americans and said we will run our own pragmatic China policy. We didn't give anything away. What I've been advocating is more or less get back to the national interest-based policy that Abbott, after a few initial mistakes in his first 3 months as Prime Minister, had running pretty satisfactorily. We had had President Xi come to Australia. We had a free trade agreement with them. They elevated the relationship to what they call a comprehensive strategic partnership, terminology the Chinese like. We were doing reasonably well on China policy. Why can't we get back to it? I think we've taken the diplomacy out of the relationship. We've relied too much on advice from security agencies. And we somehow think that we impress Washington by appearing to be adversarial. What good has it done us to become the American ally with the most fraught policy with China? Japan and India are busy running pragmatic China policies. Japan and an American ally, and India an American partner. Meanwhile, Singapore has made it clear that in view of America's declining attention to Asia and the simple rise of China, it too has got to have pragmatic engagement, though that is the better course than some sort of adversarial rhetorical tilt, which has captured Australia since early 2017.
So tell us a bit about the other great New South Wales Labor figure. You're roughly the same age. I'm not talking about Paul Keating. You're roughly the same age as Paul Keating. Paul Keating was very keen to get Jack Lang back into the Labor Party, in spite of the huge damage he'd done to Labor over several decades. I mean, did you come across Lang, and what was the fixation about Lang among Paul Keating's group?
Keating's father had been a Langite. Keating's father, so he imbued that. John McCarthy and I, in Young Labor, were Langites. How did your father line up? He was part of the Federal Party, Terry, wasn't he? As opposed to Lang, in the Chifley faction. It took us a bit of time.
The greatest pity about Lang was that he didn't become the Speaker of the House of Representatives.
Yeah.
Terry's saying that his father thought the greatest pity about Lang was he didn't become the Speaker of the House of Representatives.
Right. Which would have kept him locked into the Chifley government. It took us, my generation made a bit of an intellectual journey to discover the McKell tradition. And by the late 70s, our view was that William McKell, Premier 41 to 47, and later Governor General, was a more substantial leader than Lang. Lang was the careerist turned demagogue. Lang had no answer to the Great Depression except rhetoric, and he was very disloyal to Chifley and the Chifley government. We found that McKell laid down a course for New South Wales Labor, later picked up by Carl, and later still by Neville Rann, that was the greater contribution to the politics of centre-left, social democratic Labor parties. But we were slow to get to that point. So I would disdain the Lang legacy and uphold the McKell legacy. I think that would be the position Paul Keating would probably occupy today, although he has a fondness for this big personality He used to meet on weekly visits down at Nithsdale Street in the office of the Century newspaper. Keating told me once that he went in there to see Lang, and such a figure of the last century was Lang that he had his shoes and socks off and his trousers rolled up in a basin of mustard water because he thought that that combated the head cold. So he was an ancient figure, but I think Keating liked the brutally realistic things Lang would say about power. And it was part of an education to have an older figure, even if one he was later to find out was fatally flawed.
We're getting close to the end, they've got to be brief, okay?
Mr. Carr, you've referred to some of the infrastructure you delivered in your time. As you look around Sydney now, it feels like it's being remade. And we all know about the Western Sydney Airport and the Western Sydney Metro that's the horizon. My question, I suppose, is do you look at that and think, I would have liked to have been able to do some of this when I was in power, and is the principal reason you weren't the fact that the trade union movement stopped you doing things like privatising the poles and wires?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've got a chapter that deals with this. The increase in infrastructure spending in my 10.5 years as Premier in real terms was 41%. If that's not the public impression, 41%. Our standout achievement was something that had to be done, which was the completion of a ring road system around Sydney, Eastern Distributor, through to M7 Westlink, the Lane Cove Tunnel, the Cross City Tunnel, much criticised, but you can't imagine Sydney without it, but the biggest one, M7 Westlink, over 40 kilometres running north to south in Sydney's west, mobilising, because I did not have the proceeds of electricity privatisation, mobilising private capital and requiring tolls, modest by the current standards, as people use the roads. That was policy innovation, but one I inherited from Greiner, M4 and M5, and adjusted as required. I would have liked to have been able to complete the South West Rail Line, finished and opened by one of my successors, Labor successors, earlier. But as it was, we were able to give commuters from the MacArthur region something they didn't have before our big investment in rail, which was express rail services from MacArthur to the central business district. My party, backed by public opinion, made a decision that we would not have the proceeds of electricity privatisation. And that meant waiting longer for the element that electricity privatisation has funded, the current government's plans, which is the link between the northwest rail sector, which we had locked into place, and Sydney's underground network.
Final brief question, Lindsay.
As obscure as you might have been as leader of the opposition, I recall that Nick Greiner gave a degree of credibility to you by letting you speak at state functions. That's a degree of civility that we don't see now, and although it was the bear pit then, it still is. Does that make much difference, do you think, the degree of civility we have in politics and respect for the institutions?
It's hard to say. Every generation regrets the absence of civility that previously existed. Every generation does that. So we might be kidding ourselves. There seemed to be something, and there are serious historians here, but there seems to have been something in the mutual respect between Chifley and Menzies, although Menzies is on record speaking to...
And Curtin.
And John Edwards, the Curtin biographer, is with us. There seemed to be something in that old Parliament House, and we can speculate endlessly why it's not there. But I'm certain a lot... I'm sticking my neck out in saying this, but I am certain that there are a lot of people who might otherwise be recruited to a political career who are put off by what they see as the cruelty of the energetic name-calling that takes place. There is some reward there for the politician who somehow summons the imagination to curtail that and make civility a living, walking, breathing, pulsating reality in the parliamentary chamber. It's something that eluded me.
Many thanks. Well, I think the last time Bob Carr addressed the Sydney Institute was, I think, on the occasion of your diaries, and created a lot of interest with references to pyjamas and some kind of crushed nuts. I can't remember what they were. And this time, is it, what is it, sausage rolls or Sim Sims or whatever it was you've got a whole chapter on. Look, I think the point about both the diaries and Run For Your Life, the diaries being done allegedly contemporaneously, unless I like Clyde Cameron's, which were done 10 years after the event. But
or Mark Latham.
Or Mark Latham. and this book, Run For Your Life, which is a memoir, political memoir, is they're both highly entertaining. And we've seen that tonight. It's a very entertaining talk. An important reflection in your about both New South Wales and national politics, but done in a very entertaining way. And so for tonight, as I said, we've got copies of the book for sale at the end. But for tonight, congratulations, well done, and we'll have you back with the next one.
Okay.
Thanks, folks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.